Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM, Channel 141. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. Mother's Day is this weekend. It is a time to honor mom, but it is also historically the weekend that Howard University has held its commencement ceremonies. It's a day that hard-studying graduates and sacrificing parents have long waited for. This year, however, the coronavirus pandemic has changed everything at colleges and universities around the world and at Howard University. And tonight, we talked to President Dr. Wayne Frederick about the impact of COVID-19 on Howard and plans for the future. Lines are open. Give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Tweet us using the hashtag WHURFM. Dr. Frederick, thanks for joining me.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you for being on the program. I am not looking forward to this weekend. I've got a daughter that's graduating as well. What's going to happen on Saturday?
Well, on Saturday, we will have a virtual conferring of degrees in which the part of the commencement ceremony that we traditionally have, we have already taped in the sequence that it usually is in. And we will go to every school and college and formally confer their degrees in the manner that we do with the, you know, the blessing of the Board of Trustees and obviously the power that they invest in me to allow me, that invested me to allow me to do that. It is not, and I'm not trying to advertise it as a virtual commencement because that's not what it is. We'd be, this, each school and college will have an individual ceremony during the course of this week, as they usually do on campus, in which they will be calling on their graduates by name. And I believe at least 12 of the 13 schools and colleges are going to have one of those ceremonies this week.
You said on campus, would that also be a virtual procedure?
It will all be virtual. All of the ceremonies will be virtual. And I simply apologize for your loss of that moment, Harold, as a parent. I know how special and how meaningful this is. And like I've said in the past, this was a very difficult decision to make because I know what the importance is of an activity like this.
You said yourself that when you graduated from Howard, your grandmother took her first airplane flight, and that was really a big deal for her. What do you want parents to know? What's your message to parents?
Yeah, you know, it probably was a bigger deal for me than it was for her. You can imagine that. And as she sits today at the age of 95, about to 96 next month, and
wow,
she reflects on that, you know, back in 1988, some 32 years ago. You know, I think of what she still enjoys every day, and that is, you know, having seen me from birth and the evolution of myself into a young adult and into, you know, full adulthood, navigating and traversing life's challenges and being supportive, being there. And at the end of the day, commencement is a destination. It's not part of the journey per se, but it is one destination, one stop on the journey. And I always say that, you know, I'm obsessed with the journey of life and no single destination, because no single destination would ever fulfill us. But the fulfillment is in how we enjoy the journey, how much energy we put into it, and how we embrace it. And I would say for parents, I think the thing to really focus on is that journey, to look at your young people, especially this weekend, and to think of all that they have been through, you know, middle school, high school. When they first got to college, the feelings of anxiety you probably had, and now you know, watching them navigate yet another leg on that journey. And I had to take comfort in that, as well as to embrace the fact that they're going to be going on to even greater things. And next year, in 2021, we do plan to celebrate this class in person with a formal commencement ceremony on campus.
I'm talking to Dr. Wayne Frederick, president of Howard University, about the impact of the coronavirus pandemic has had on Howard University. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Can you take me back to what seems like eons ago now, to when you made the decision to cancel the on-campus graduation? What kind of went into that process, not only for you as a president of a university, but also as a physician? Because there's always one person out there when we often talk to you, you know, who does not know that you are a physician and a person who is an active surgeon, and arguably one of the best educated college presidents in America. So what was that decision process like?
You know, well the first part of it, how it was health and safety. I had to make an assessment based on the information that we had at that time, about what the health and safety, concerns were and how we could mitigate any risk. And the first thing that was obvious to me is that any congregation of people of any quantities would be risky. Grandmothers, grandfathers attend graduations. And I immediately felt that that would be a major risk for us as a community to have such an event, because those most vulnerable amongst us would have been at risk. What has since happened, obviously, is we've now found out that disproportionately African Americans are being really affected by the epidemic, by the pandemic, sorry. And that would have been for us a potential disaster to do. So very early on, I felt that health and safety had to be the first guiding. That was one. The second thing that concerned me was that we run a hospital, and therefore we would have a responsibility to really ensure that our hospital was ready to manage what was taking place. And so the other thing that meant is that over the period of the next month or two, our resources as an institution would really need to be guided towards trying to staff the hospital up, ensure that we could do that, and therefore our ability to manage classes on campus or major commencement ceremony would have been impaired severely. And then not knowing how rapidly the virus was spreading and whether we would have a surge in that time, what I also didn't want to do was delay making the decision, have people make travel plans, and then find out that in late April we were overwhelmed, you know, as a medical facility, and we would be bringing people into, you know, a very difficult circumstance. So I would say that was really the sequence of thought process that led to the decision.
You made this decision before the lion's share of colleges and universities were doing the same. Howard University was one of the first major universities in this country to do that, and I believe Boston University and some other major universities followed suit. Had you had any conversations after you made this decision with your colleagues at other universities? Did they come to you for counsel, for advice about the decision that you made?
Yeah, you know, I have been speaking to other colleagues about the decision and what factored in. And like I said, I told several other people that having a hospital on the my portfolio was a factor, thinking of what those needs would be like, what we were doing, and looking at the pandemic from a public health perspective, getting data and information that otherwise, you know, we wouldn't necessarily be paying as close attention to. And as you pointed out, I am a physician, and so looking at it from that health perspective, I did not see a way in which we would be able to congregate as we usually did on Mother's Day weekend. I just did not see that path. And so I did have an advantage based on some of those items that you just pointed out in terms of making that decision and having probably a slightly different perspective.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. I'm talking to Dr. Wayne Frederick. He's the president of Howard University, about the impact of the coronavirus pandemic on Howard University. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810. Even as you look forward with some sense of difficulty, I would argue, through this weekend, I'm sure that there are already plans or discussions about what is going to happen in the fall. Do you have any thoughts about where the university is going for the 2020-2021 school year?
Yeah, you know, that's an excellent question. We are planning for face-to-face on-campus classroom instruction activity, with the caveat that, again, the status of the pandemic and the status of our hospital, our ability to provide services, and more importantly, the DC area will dictate those things. New York, for instance, has hit its peak and is now on the other side of the curve. D.C. has not. And interestingly enough, D.C. is still on the upswing. Social distancing has flattened the curve here in D.C. And one of the consequences of flattening the curve is that you lengthen the pandemic, as it were, by accident. And so that is, you know, part of the concern in terms of how long this would last. And we may not be fully back to, you know, into reopen phase until July, per se. And then obviously the very next month is when we start bringing students back, et cetera. So there are a few principles we're going to focus on, first of which, again, is going to be health. Safety. Second is to make sure that we don't compromise the quality of what we do. And then the third is going to be to try to mitigate any risk of a second wave and or a flu season. So to manage those three things, there are several things that we're going to do. We're looking at testing. I've stood up a task force committee made up of constituents from all around the campus, but we also have invited the councilwoman from our ward, Brianne Ledeau. We've invited an ANC commissioner. We're going to invite an alum from the Greater Washington chapter as well. And the purpose will be to look at all of the factors. So testing is one. When we do test, how we manage that testing and how often do we test? Do we have students and faculty test before they come back? Or do we provide those tests when people are here on campus? The second thing is, what do we do with the test results? How do we contact trace? And that is, how do we look around for the people that that person may be in contact with to either identify where they may have gotten the infection from and how to prevent further spread? Where do we self-quarantine? The consortium of universities in D.C. is looking at potentially having, you know, a shared resource where we may put students and a few others who may contract the disease and need to be self-quarantined in one place, as an example. So there's several things, and that's just on the testing. When it comes to how many people you put in the classroom, do we start later, finish the semester early to avoid the next flu season? All of these potential, you know, strategies that we may have to employ to ensure that we are able to do this successfully.
Need to take a break. When we come back, more about the impact of the coronavirus on the Howard University community, as well as a new hospital coming to the campus and a broader look at the COVID-19 pandemic in the District of Columbia. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM, Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Angela's Dribbling is next with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. This conversation continues on Sirius XM, Channel 141, in just a few seconds. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM, Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight, we're talking to Howard University President Dr. Wayne Frederick about the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on the Howard University community and plans for the future. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. One other question, Dr. Frederick, do you see the possibilities that classrooms will look like much of the street does right now, with students, professors in masks?
You know, that is a strong possibility, and it will, I think there are a few things that will dictate that. One would be what is called the reproduction number, which is looking at rate of infections in the area. Our testing results, depending on how those tests are conducted. And also when we look at risk around how many vulnerable people we may have in any given classroom, whether that's a student or a faculty member, I think all of those things will have to be factors in that. Now, there are other things that we have to do to mitigate, which is going to include significant disinfecting of the campus on a regular basis, how we clean the campus at the end of each day, or even cleaning during the day, would probably have to be intensified, adding hand washing stations around the campus, maybe some portable ones may also factor into those types of things as well. And then obviously the spacing of seating in the classroom. So we may have to look at creative solutions for that. In some circumstances, we may have to encourage all online instruction, but have half of the class, for instance, come in on one day and the other half on another day, as an example, you know, while the half that's not in class gets the instruction online. So some may say, well, why bring people back to campus in the first place? And I think the other thing that we have to look at that is different now, that we have to be cautious of, that we don't lose, is one of the major elements of a successful Howard education is that ability to interact and to have that discourse, to have that. It's difficult to recreate that online. I think the faculty have done an excellent job of doing that. But, you know, 80% of the time that students spend on a campus, like ours, is spent outside of the classroom. And so there's a great opportunity for them to learn from one another, interact with one another, to grow and develop, you know, their personalities, et cetera. And that gives them the opportunity to do so, even with physical distancing.
Well, let me ask you about that, Dr. Frederick, because we are still in social distancing mode, but what about homecoming? Mm. There is no event like a Howard homecoming. And it is, social distancing just doesn't seem to equal a Howard homecoming.
Yeah, you know, the committee that's looking at us coming back is going to have to look at that, right? We have several large events like the opening ceremony in Crampton. Homecoming is another, you know, all of these we're going to have to look at and think creatively, you know, how we can, you know, reproduce, if not stand these up. And so I'll be taking a recommendation from that committee made up, you know, which will also include students as to what that will look like as well. But you bring up a good point. I mean, all of these types of activities that we traditionally have on our campus in the way that we've had them in the past are things that we will have to revisit and relook at. And so these are some of the things I expect the team to be providing me feedback on as well.
Are you concerned about the financial impact that this pandemic is going to have on the university?
Yeah, I'm very concerned. You know, first and foremost, if you look at let's look at the economy, because obviously we're a microcosm of that. You've had over 30 million Americans file for unemployment since the start of stay-at-home orders. The workforce in the U.S. is probably around 160 million, somewhere between probably 150 to 165 million to be. And therefore, you're talking about an unemployment rate in the high teens just from who filed unemployment. Lots of states were overwhelmed just because of the sheer number of people that were filing. So the number of unemployed is probably higher. So you're talking about potentially an unemployment rate that was at a historic low that could balloon to 20%. That is going to have a major impact on our families. Traditionally, the unemployment rate among African Americans has been even higher than the national average unemployment rate. So if you'd start taking the unemployment rate among African Americans into the 20s, you're talking about one in every five, one in every four African Americans who are in the workforce could be filing for unemployment. They are going to be the parents and guardians of our students. And they would have made plans to send their students to us based on their economic circumstance when the student first enrolled with us. If the student is a rising senior, rising junior, rising sophomore, or a first-time in college student who would have applied back in November or February. And so you really are looking at a fairly complicated circumstance with respect to enrollment. And if that enrollment falls, it obviously affects net tuition revenue and therefore affects our finances. That's one aspect of it. Mm-hmm. The ability to conduct research in this environment has been hampered, and so our ability to bring in research dollars could be severely compromised. To ramp the hospital up, we had to turn off our elective clinical operations. So that meant seeing patients in person for chronic illnesses like diabetes, heart disease, hypertension, et cetera. And also, as in my field with surgical oncology, we had to shut down operating. Those procedures are the bread and butter of the revenue at the hospital. So by turning those off, we really then compromise the net patient service revenue as another line item. And then The fourth one that is, I think, major is philanthropic contributions. We are on pace to have the most significant year of philanthropy at the university. We have raised in excess of $34.5 million already this year. To put that in perspective, we had been raising anywhere from 10 to 12 million at the time that I started and had taken that up to a high of about 20 million. So this year in particular had been a banner year for philanthropy, and we have been planning significant investments in that area. Mm-hmm. Those four major revenue streams are all going to be compromised, and therefore the finances of the university will be significantly impacted as we go forward. So we really have to make sure that we running efficiently, that we're taking all the appropriate cost-cutting measures, And we obviously want to keep the work staff, the employed staff as full as possible. Yeah. And so we all are going to have to be diligent about spending as we go into next year.
Let's talk a little bit about going forward. The huge announcement last week about a new hospital for Howard University, and in this being part of a, you know, this larger plan of work that's going to be happening east of the river. Can you kind of give me the cliff notes, you know, of this deal, you know, particularly as it relates to Adventist Healthcare participating and helping to make this happen?
Sure. So there are two aspects of what was announced. One is that there will be a hospital built in Southeast in conjunction with George Washington's hospital owner, UHS, and they're going to do that in conjunction with the D.C. government. Howard University is not participating in that activity. There'll be a second hospital built to replace the Howard University Hospital as well. And the mayor and D.C., what the mayor is proposing is that there would be some portion of contribution that will come from the D.C. government that will, you know, probably cover a fifth of the cost of the hospital, and then in conjunction with Adventist, Howard and Adventist will seek the remaining funding for the hospital. And so that is the plan as it exists. Right now, we think it is a strong plan for us to go forward. It represents a significant investment in the nation's healthcare pipeline, especially around a diverse healthcare workforce as well. Howard continues to send more African Americans to medical school than anyone else. We produce more black physicians in this country than any other single institution since the onset of formal medical education in America. And so the only dental school and the only pharmacy school in the district, Nursing and Allied Health, which completes interprofessional healthcare education like no other campus can. And so it is a significant investment and a significant directional move as well.
The 2 years ago, there was a lot of difficult negotiation that seemed to be going nowhere at that time. Particularly when you had spoken about, you know, the need for Howard University medical students to be active participants in the health disparities that we saw east of the river. And those patients are still being served mostly by, you know, Howard University. What was the turnaround from your perspective?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a good question. There are two things I'll say. One is, you know, Frederick Douglass is famous for having said that there are those among us who want to reap the harvest, but we don't necessarily want the thunder and lightning that comes with the rain that allows the crops to grow. And I would say that, you know, those, what you describe as difficult conversations probably were the thunder and lightning that led to the rain. And I think it sensitized everyone to probably take a different look at who we were, what the contribution was, et cetera. And I think upon doing that, you know, I have to give credit to Mayor Bowser and her leadership. You know, she really led her team to have a different kind of conversation with us about, you know, what the possibilities were and how those things can work. And so in a lot of ways, she really crafted an appropriate solution. And so the second thing that I would underscore, that made the difference was her leadership.
Besides a new building, how will the new hospital be different from the hospital that now sits on Georgia Avenue?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, that hospital was built in 1971. So just like me being born in that year with my old knees and my often sore back and neck, it has some aging pains that you just can't fix, no matter, how much good intent you have, because it was just constructed at a different time. You know, there's shared bathrooms and things of that nature that just won't fit today's, standards. Technology-wise, the hospital of the future, again, is a smart hospital, as it were, just as we have smartphones. What people are doing with beds, how people get vital signs, how we collect samples from patients, how we transport patients, all of those things are being influenced by technology today, technology that can be built in to patient rooms, to nursing stations, how meds get delivered, all of those things are, very different. And so it will differ in terms of how technology is embedded in the hospital itself. The second thing is in the memorandum that we signed with the mayor's office, there's an investment in centers of excellence at Howard University, and that includes in areas that are very near and dear to us, sickle cell, diabetes, these types of things, maternal health. So again, a significant and pointed investment in overall healthcare. And so yes, while the hospital will be a centerpiece of an academic medical center, there's significant investment in clinical areas of concern that address the healthcare disparities. Trauma and violence prevention, as an example, is one of the centers of excellence. So I think there's a lot of investment in the appropriate areas that ultimately will impact the overall health outcomes for those populations that unfortunately have been left behind in the past.
I think what you just shared with us is a great way to turn to some of the broader issues of what's happening right now in the District of Columbia, where you talk about health disparities, underlying health conditions, diabetes, obesity, heart disease, hypertension, and I could go on and on and on. And the press conferences that we watch, specifically, of course, in the District of Columbia, but everywhere, there's the one thing that really kind of stands out is that Black people are at serious risk because of the pandemic. And in the District of Columbia, for example, we have the most deaths in Ward 8. Ward 4, the information was released today that members of the Latinx community have the most cases, and that we are also seeing people under 40, more cases under 40. From your perspective as a physician, what kind of goes through your mind as we try to fight this disease in a city that is nearly 50% African American?
Yeah, grave concern, I have to tell you. And unfortunately, some of these things are very, very familiar to me. When I look back at when I first came back to Howard University in 2006, in a 24-month period, I had seen 22 women with fungating breast masses. And what that describes are breast cancers that grew so large that they grew through the skin, through the patient's nipple. You could not even recognize that it was a breast if I took a picture of it. And I had spent my time at MD Anderson Cancer Center at University of Connecticut, and I had not seen one single patient with that disease. All of these women were African-American women. And it really, you know, made me stop and think about the difficulty that the African-American population was facing in terms of their health outcomes in the city. If you live in Ward 8, your life expectancy is about 72 years. I believe some 90% plus of that population is African-American. If you live in Ward 3, where, you know, an equally high percentage of that population is white, your life expectancy is 87.6 years. That big gap in just a few miles separated in the middle by the capital in the most powerful country in the world is one of the worst stories that we could be telling today. And so those inequities exist. And I think it is now our responsibility to ensure that those inequities are resolved. And to do that, you have to look at the social determinants of health, which include food insecurity, transportation, access to care. You know, so there's several areas of investment. And the mayor has asked me to co-chair the subcommittee on equity and vulnerable populations as we look to reopen D.C. And I think it provides an opportunity once and for all for us to make investments in our city, appropriate investments in the right places in our city, in the right types of systems in Washington, D.C., in order to make sure that these inequities are completely eradicated going forward.
That's an interesting point when you talk about speaking to, you know, our public servants about dealing with some of these disparities, food deserts, which is kind of, you know, one of the foundational issues. And we've seen during the course of this pandemic in the District of Columbia just how incredibly hard the district government has worked to make sure that, people are fed. I mean, the mobilization is arguably the same kind of mobilization that was seen in World War II, to make sure that people are fed, that people are not homeless, that businesses are able to survive, and the like. But on the other side of that, is this pandemic also sending a message to members of the Black community about what we must do, or if we can do for ourselves to make sure that we are healthy, whether it has to do with not only what we eat, but how we eat, and how, if we have access to health care, going and checking, you know, men may be less likely to go to see a doctor than women. All of those things. Is there a message for the other side?
Yeah, absolutely. Part of that message is that we have to rally around each other. We have to demonstrate empathy, and that we have a full understanding. Most of the patients who do not participate in these activities that you are speaking about don't, not because they don't want to, but because they don't have the opportunity to. If you live in Ward 7 and 8 and you look at the number of grocery stores versus the density of grocery stores between Wards 1 and 3, it is amazing, the disparity. So therefore, when you ask about eating healthy, that's easier said than done. When you're an essential worker and you're out, you know, bus driving, doing all the other things, and you get home at a certain hour when the convenience isn't there in your neighborhood to be able to pick up something healthy, then you pick up something that nourishes, whether it's healthy or not. And so, you know, those accesses are an issue. Prenatal care access in Ward 7 and 8 is minimal. So when you look at high-risk pregnancies and maternal mortality, African-American women who live in those wards are far more likely to have significant problems, you know, in terms of being able to really justify what we must do, you know. So it's a, I guess one of the things I want to be sure that we are clear about is that we have to build infrastructure and place resources in the appropriate places. And if we do not do that, we will have problems going forward. So on the other side of this, we must. It is imperative that we must rally around and do the right things as we go forward.
Speaking of rallying around, this week is National Teacher and National Nurses Appreciation Week. Any words for those people who are in the trenches of this pandemic?
You know, the first word I have is gratitude. I got into medicine because I have sickle cell, and I have always had a full understanding and full appreciation of healthcare workers on the front line as well as essential workers. I was a patient long before I was a physician. My mom was a nurse for 51 years, and so I grew up understanding the sacrifices that she made, the hours that she would have to go out to work and come back home when she was put out at a post way on the other side of the island from us, and would be there for 2 weeks before we would see her at a time, you know, over a month. I understood that sacrifice. What this has brought out and what I hope all of the frontline workers, and I'm especially concerned about the non-healthcare workers who we often overlook as well, those who provide transportation, grocery store folks. We cannot live without recognizing our interconnectedness. And I hope that is one of the things that resonates with them. They have always known their worth. They have not decided to have the entire population appreciate them before they appreciated themselves. So I hope that they would always take solace in the fact that they have understood what they meant to all of us, and that now all of us have an opportunity to take pause and appreciate them. And I hope that they would be satisfied that they are doing exactly what they were called to do. It is making a major difference. It has been making a major difference even prior to this, and that this situation has just illuminated for us what they're doing. And I hope for the rest of us, all of us, we would take the opportunity every day, every time we encounter, you know, people who work in these jobs, to just acknowledge them in the way that our humanity should inspire us to.
Mm-hmm. Last week, real quick, I saw you at the press conference. You had a mask on. You mentioned sickle cell. That's one condition, but, you know, you've been very public about your type 1 diabetes. My daughter is the same. I've worked to make sure, the family has worked, I should say, to make sure that she remains protected. Are you doing everything that you need to do to protect yourself? It made me nervous seeing you there, even social distancing during that press conference.
Yeah, it's a risk. And there's no day that I don't leave my house without, you know, I take my wife and my kids, you know, wanting me to be at home, or for that matter, employing me to be cautious and be careful. And so I'm doing everything possible. As we expand the hospital, you know, I have to be there to ensure that project is going well. As you mentioned, I'm an active surgeon, so I still have patients that I need to see. There are patients who are still coming into the hospital with acute issues that unfortunately have major cancer diagnoses, major abdominal cancers, and I'm still taking care of those patients as well while doing everything possible to certainly protect myself as best as I can. It is a risk, and it's one that I signed up for, you know, back in 1994 when I took my oath at type of graduation. And so it's one that I intend to continue to fulfill, albeit, you know, taking the right precautions.
Well, Dr. Frederick, continue to be safe. And thank you for the work that you're doing during this unusual and extremely difficult time. But please take care of yourself. And I thank you for spending some time with us.
I will. Thank you very much for all that you're doing as well by getting the word out to our community. Appreciate you.
Absolutely. That is the Daily Drum for this Monday, May 4th. I'm Harold Fisher. Now stay tuned for The Connection. Be safe. Good night.